On this episode of the 8-Bit Files, we're going to be talking about basic programming and how the 8-bit computer, like the Atari and the Commodore 64, was really fundamental for us learning how to program BASIC, and probably a lot of you as well.
I'm Dave.
And I'm John. Let's get into it.
The 8-Bit Files with Dave and John.
All right, John. So by now our listeners know that you were the Atari guy, I was the Commodore guy. The Commodore 64 had BASIC, the BASIC programming language built into it. What about your Atari 800 XL?
It had it also built in. The previous edition of the Ataris, the 400 and 800, they had a cartridge slot dedicated just for they had a left and a right cartridge. And typically you put your operating system on one side and then your, you know, game or whatever else on the other side. But on the XL series, it was built in.
Right. So you could fire up the XL. You'd be taken to I'm assuming, like a ready prompt, like a flashing cursor, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. Just a blue screen and a ready prompt.
Well, there you go. Could you start plunking in your basic code right then and there? Or did you have to go into some sort of a mode or something to start that?
No, you could just start typing away. And, you know, I used to go to, as we mentioned, Sears, at least in Canada, was a hotbed of computing activity for our age. And I used to go to Sears, and they had a demo computer. It doesn't matter if it was a Commodore or a VIC-20, Atari, doesn't matter. You would always be able to get to BASIC somehow. And then I would put my name and I would do, you know, 10 print John space, you know, and then I would do go to 10, the next line. And then I would just have my name on all these screens on all these computers, much to the chagrin of the salesperson.
Not knowing how to hit the stop key or whatever it would have been to stop. Yeah. That's funny. I did exactly the same thing, except I put a semicolon at the end of the print statement so that it would actually like cascade down the screen.
I wasn't sure how syntax accurate you wanted me to be. I would always put a leading space though, so that it would actually have some room, and then it would sort of cascade down the screen and it would just keep going and going and going. And I'm sure I sold a lot of computers that way with room on the screen.
Right on. So when you, when you first started using the Atari machine, of course, games were a big part of what we used the computers for. What percentage of your 800 XL time was spent writing BASIC versus playing games?
It's interesting because even before the Atari, on my TRS-80 Model 3, I was entering stuff in from magazines because, you know, there was no internet back then. And this was also pre-BBS for me. So you either bought a cartridge or a disc if you had or a tape, I guess, at the very beginning, to load them. But, you know, there was a lot of really good software that literally was being published in magazines. So I spent a lot of time typing in BASIC programs. Which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, same here. And I think I remember mentioning in our Commodore episode that I lived my first year with my Commodore 64 with a tape drive and no disc drive. So very limited. So that kind of forced me, I guess, to learn how to program, to learn how to write BASIC programs. So my friend, all my friends were named Mike back then, it seems. My friend Mike across the street, he was, you know, my best friend at the time, and still in contact with him once in a while these days. But he had a VIC-20, and because the dialect of BASIC on the VIC-20 and on the 64 were pretty much the same. Of course, the machines had completely different capabilities, or the 64 was much more capable. We could actually learn BASIC programming together, and we actually wrote games, very simple games, of course, for the time. Back then, I guess we were only 12 years old. So I guess, what do you expect, right? But we were able to write a little bit of BASIC code, share it, and just learn the differences between the different graphical display and how many characters wide the screen was in the VIC-20 compared to the 64, and just sort of make adjustments there. So it's actually kind of fun to try to write little programs that were cross-platform. Even back then, it was really cool.
Could you imagine the Xbox generation having to enter in their games so they could play them?
Well, maybe they'd,
kids these days
even more. Well, I know, but I mean, back then, because we had to work for it, right? Yeah. So the work, the stuff that we would do, that me and Mike would do, it was a combination of creating our own stuff completely from scratch and a combination of stealing other people's code and modifying it, of course, right? Which is, I mean, that's really how we learned back then too, was to look at examples, right? Those type in examples from magazines. I remember there was this skiing game. A game, like a very simple game with a skier at the top of the screen, having to basically, you're moving left to right to navigate through the flags, I guess, on the ski hill, if that's right. The right way.
Like a slalom?
Yeah, precisely, yeah. Precisely. And Mike was, and maybe Mike, I'll send this podcast to Mike so he can correct my mistakes here, but Mike was much more musically inclined than I was back then. He had a gift for music, and so what we did, some of the modifications we would make to, I remember this slalom game, that skiing game, is we added, or he added, the A-Team theme song to it. So, you know, ba, 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 ba. I still remember C-G-C, F-G-C. I think that's what it was. And like, I know nothing about music, but Mike, you know, he'll probably correct me, but I just remember, you know, it was a lot of fun. You know, we're 12 years old and we're modifying, you know, this code and, you know, making these computers do things like that. It was a whole lot of fun. Really, really, really was.
I don't remember where the idea came from or even sort of the source material, but at some point I kind of did the same thing. It wasn't adding music, but I took some very basic game mechanics that I saw in a magazine. I think it was probably like an example of like how to build a game. These are all the sort of the libraries that you would need to sort of build out to make things work. And what I did is I strung them all together and made a new game. And it was like basically a Space Invaders style of game, you know, the top down shooting kind of thing. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, I think I was probably 9 or 10 at the time. And this is the thing that I actually sent into in Canada. We have had a magazine, I think it was called Compute Canada. And they would publish at the back all these printouts of games, and I had mine printed out, and I think I got $10 and a copy of the magazine for doing that.
Nice. You still have it?
No, sadly.
that didn't make the move across Canada, I guess.
No, it did not.
No.
It was just one of those things. And I've looked everywhere. I can't find a copy of it online. Mm-hmm. I can't even find a mention of this particular magazine. Like it died long before the internet, and you know, I'm sure somebody has a copy in their garage somewhere, but yeah. I have yet to come across it.
Yeah. I remember again the year of the tape drive, 1983 through 1984, before I got my disk drive. I remember when making a trip to the big city, you know, from the small town in the summertime, picking up a book called the Commodore 64 Games Book. It was one of many books of the era that had program listings in them. And were actually educational as well. And like you said, they would actually, like the magazines would do, this book actually went into a fair amount of detail describing different routines and different, I guess, techniques for game programming. And I remember like being on vacation, having just bought this book, just studying every single page. And in your mind, these were like the best, highest quality arcade games examples that were in this magazine, right? And then you get home and you type one of them in and you're sadly disappointed that
you didn't get Donkey Kong. You got
that's right
something much worse.
That's right. But I tell you though, I remember this book inspiring me and teaching me a whole lot, like, you know, back then. And I remember converting some of the code into my own game. And I'm probably got my facts all wrong here, but this was, again, my friend Mike and I, we called it MD Invaders, right? So of course, Space Invaders, all games were like Space Invaders, like shoot 'em up back then, right?
Yeah, they were the easiest ones to program.
That's exactly right. And I remember thinking, getting frustrated at how slow the basic interpreter would run on the Commodore 64. So you have your little character at the your ship at the bottom. You fire a missile at, you know, an alien or whatever it was, and you'd wait for it to get to the top of the screen. And it was like tapping your computer to make this thing go a little bit faster. And maybe that's why, you know, maybe that's why a little bit of the luster and the excitement of basic programming might have sort of faded a little bit, because you did realize that it was somewhat limited. And learning machine language at that time would have been just completely out of the scope of 12-year-old Dave's brain anyways.
Yeah, that was like a university level course, basically. At least in my head, it was. I was always fascinated that people could program in assembly language, you know, even back in the Apple days. And how complex it was. And then I realized, oh, they're actually not writing in zeros and ones. They're
They're
using compilers. So
But I took actually took an assembly language course in college. It was part of my like college curriculum, I remember. And I had studied a little bit of assembly language when I was a kid as well, but I hit a wall in terms of my I just wasn't interested. I don't know, but certainly understood the concepts. But now, I guess put it on the list of things to maybe spend some of your spare time doing if you want to learn assembly language at, you know, 50 years old or whatever the case may be, if you want. But I'll talk a little bit more about assembly language later, because it does sort of tie into a story. But I just wanted to just to cover off that era, that sort of VIC 20, when I'd go to my friend Mike's house across the street. We were like joined at the hip on this stuff. We took cassette tapes, because he had a tape drive, I had a tape drive. We didn't have disk drives. We would take a cassette tape and put a label on it and copy our game to it, like Ski 64 or whatever, our skiing game, and put it in like a plastic bag and basically pile these up, like on the basis that we were going to one day sell these things. Like we were a software company, right? Like we have, and actually I still have a couple of these tapes in my closet. It's one of the few relics I have from back then.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. MD software. And a couple of years ago, I think it was during like peak pandemic times when we really had time on our hands. I remember taking some of those tapes out of the closet and actually trying to convert them, try to get the data out of them. So, and I actually managed to get a couple of the programs converted over. So anyway, that's another topic for another day. But it was, you know, we had wild dreams of becoming, you know, we weren't quite, you know, Paul Allen and Bill Gates. it didn't quite, you know, work out that way, at least not yet. Maybe we're still working our way there, but it was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. But it's just crazy that you actually still have that software and you've been able to pull it out and run it on your Commodore.
Yeah. I remember texting Mike to tell him about that right away, and we've still been meaning, like threatening to get together to go to relive this stuff and to, you know, to go down memory lane and mm-hmm. you know, fire up the VIC 20. So so that was in addition to the game, sort of experimenting with game programming in BASIC. I remember when I got my Commodore 128, so I upgraded from the 64 to the 128 in about 85. And the 128 brought an extensive, like a massive upgrade to BASIC from the 64 version. And it was like literally went from like version 2, which is like the 64 BASIC, to like a version 7. Like, I don't know where those five versions in between went. but version 7, I think it was version 7 of the 128, brought all kinds of advanced commands for creating like graphics, like plot, like to plot like a high resolution graphic in BASIC. I don't even think it's possible on the Commodore 64, really, not easily anyway.
Yeah.
But on the 128, with these new commands and these different graphics modes, I remember Christmas morning, the first thing I did when I got that computer was fire up. And I remember I wrote a drawing program that used some of these new features, and it was actually really easy and really fun to do. The problem is that machine just didn't really catch on that much. And I remember hardly using 128 mode of that computer as well. I just used it mostly as a 64, but there was a huge improvement in performance as well, which is kind of fun.
I think something kind of similar happened on the Atari side. It wasn't that there was new hardware with this functionality, but there was new versions of BASIC that you could buy, either a cartridge or something that you run in memory that gave you those kinds of functionality that you don't have with the BASIC stuff. And I just remember being confused by it as a 9 or 10 year old. Like, I would come across software that would require a specific operating system to run. And I'm like, well, I don't have that. I don't know where to get it. And it's a physical cartridge or something I need to be able to do this. And so it seemed like, you know, a nice idea, but I think like your 64 and 128 mode on your Commodore, it was something that not a lot of people latched onto. And yeah. I think that was sort of the goal, is that, oh, well, everyone's going to buy this cartridge, so then everyone will have this capability, and then they'll just buy all this software, and it'll, you know, developers will start making software for the specific operating system that, you know, isn't sort of the default or the factory version of the software. And
yes.
So it's kind of interesting how that kind of fragmentation started happening then, with that kind of stuff. And I, again, you know, as a 9 or 10 year old, I was just like really confused, and why would I want to buy that? You know, I'll just buy a cartridge that has the game on it that I want.
Absolutely. Yeah. There were other dialects of BASIC as well back then that existed in, say, cartridge form. I remember there was something called Simon's BASIC for the 64, which I actually, only am learning about right now as well. Like, I never knew about it back then. Like you said, it would have been too much. Like, why do I need that? I already have mm-hmm. BASIC. Why do I need this BASIC from this? Who is Simon too, by the way, right? And why do I need this thing? But now I guess I'm actually more curious about it now, going and checking it out.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about sort of modern development tools and things like that in just a sec. There's one more story, and this is going to come full circle maybe. And if there's one thing I've learned in life, one thing that I don't like is leaving things like halfway done, like, you know, projects that you don't see through to completion. I mean, we're all guilty of it for whatever reason in our lives, and things are complicated, and I get that. But I remember, because we're, you know, 12-year-old Dave, you know, small town, in my circle of friends, word gets out that, David, as I was known right back then, David, can you make a computer game? Do you know how to do that? Like, you have that skill. And I'm like, yeah, I can do that. Yeah. Look, like, you know, I'm like, you know, look at me, man, I'm working. Of course I can do that. Right. And, so I remember speccing out a game with one of my non-technical friends, one of my neighbors, one of my good friends, even still to this day. And the game is called something like Kill 2048 or something like that. And it was like a kill. So 2048, of course, was like 70 years in the future back then, but now it's like 10 years from now. But basically, so we specced out, do graphics, came up with a scheme for the, like, designed all this thing on paper. And I remember I started programming it, and then for whatever reason, the project just fell off the wayside and never saw it through to completion. And it's one of those things that sticks with me. What I wonder now, all these years later, is, you know, why didn't I see it through? Was it my limitation of my skill? Did I just not have the ability to do it? I mean, of course, I was 12 years old. There's that too, right? I mean, so we've got, you know, our attention spans are probably not all that long at that age. So it's always sort of, you know, I've always remembered that. And I've always thought, maybe one day I'll go back and revisit Kill 2048. Never.
2048.
I wonder if my friend Sonny would actually remember that story. He might. We'll have to see. But it will sort of come, maybe, as I said, come full circle in a little bit.
Do you remember why you called it 2048?
I just sounded like a number that was just way in the future, right? A year that was just like,
because isn't, you know, isn't Robotron 2048?
Oh yeah. We wouldn't have been that smart though. We wouldn't have been that smart. That would have been, we would have just made it up. That's for sure. My poor friend Sonny had a Coleco Atom, right? That was his computer, basically. So
back in the day, though, I was so envious of that, because it came with a printer. It could play ColecoVision. It had a keyboard and a mouse, I think. And it was, I can't remember if it had a mouse or not. But it was pretty magical. But it was like crazy expensive to, again, someone our age at the time. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I think Donkey Kong sold a lot of Coleco Atoms too, probably. I would imagine, right? Having the Donkey Kong logo on the front of that box.
But I do remember buying, as a kid, the Timex Sinclair 1000. I think it was called the ZX or ZX 1000 elsewhere in the world. But it was touted as the $99 computer. Mm-hmm. And it's just a little thin black box. I actually have one in my garage. And its claim to fame was that you didn't need anything else. It came with BASIC. It had a membrane keyboard on the front, and it had an expansion port on the back. And you literally just plugged it into your TV like an Atari. And the thing is, the BASIC programming language, you couldn't just type letters. I mean, I think you could in a certain mode, but essentially each key was a different statement in BASIC. Like peek and poke and those kinds of things, or if then and that kind of stuff. Yes. And so you would actually type almost like phrases with each key.
Yes.
If that makes sense. And I remember loving that little computer. And there wasn't a lot of options, and basically all you could do is type in something and then turn it off. I don't even recall if I had a way to record it or store anything.
Right.
There must have been some way of doing it, or maybe you could just use any tape recorder at the time to do that. Because I do remember playing stuff that I had purchased. But it's kind of funny, because one of the things that I found one at a pawn shop like probably 20 years ago, and it's been my garage ever since. And it came with the box, and it came with an expansion module. I have a 16 kilobyte expansion module that's larger than a Nintendo cartridge.
Right. So doesn't sound inexpensive in the day, probably. Those 16K expansion would have cost it a buck or two.
It couldn't have been the same price as the computer, but it must have been serious. I never had one as a kid, though, like with mine. But it was just a black and white computer. There was no color.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's how they kept it to be $99. And so, I think it was $99 in US and Canada at the time.
Right. No, that's an interesting marketing angle. That would probably have got a few people's attention, a price point like that.
Again, could you imagine a Nintendo Switch or an Xbox black and white edition?
Yeah.
You get $20, you pay, it's $20 less, but you don't get any color.
Yeah. Well, I guess most machines of the era, right? Most of the 8-bit computers either came with some variant of BASIC built into them, or, as in the case of the Atari 400, like you mentioned, a cartridge add-on. What about the Apple computers? Like, I remember having Apple computers in school around that time. That's all we had in our computer labs over here in North America, or at least in Canada, right? So, I imagine was BASIC, I don't know if you remember, but was BASIC built into like the hardware, or did you have to boot into it? Or do you have any memory of that?
I don't remember. I know we certainly programmed in it. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the software that we ran was based in it.
Yes.
I'm just trying to remember, like, I was literally playing around with an Apple II emulator the other day, and I was reminiscing about things like Lemonade Stand and some of the other software that I used to play on the Apple that never made it to other platforms too. Like, there's this really, well, I remember it being really fun until I played it recently. It's a game called Swashbuckler.
Okay.
And literally you're like, an Errol Flynn type guy on a boat, and you go left or right, and you have a sword, and you basically have to poke and stab a never ending gauntlet of bad guys that have different types of weapons, and they're trying to stab you. But it's literally just like, the animation is so basic. Like, it's just like three different poses, and it just flips between the three poses kind of thing. Like, there's nothing to it. But I remember distinctly playing it on probably an amber or a green screen Apple II
at school.
I mean, I was probably 7 or 8 at the time. And just thinking how wonderful it was. But then I don't even know how I remembered it. Like, literally, like, in the last month, I was thinking, oh, what was that game I used to play the crap out of? And then I fired it up in the emulator, and I was like, oh, really?
Sometimes it's better to to hold on to the memory.
I mean, for the time, it was probably pretty spectacular, but Lemonade Stand was pretty advanced. I actually played that the other day, I can't remember if it was BASIC or if it was assembly, but I remember distinctly playing that in school. Probably one of the first things I ever played on a computer was Lemonade Stand.
Yep.
And there was a program called Dung Beetles.
Okay.
Did you ever play that?
Don't know that one. No.
It's kind of like a weird riff on Pac-Man. And
okay,
I'd have to look at the timelines to see if it was before Pac-Man or if it was around the same time. It might've been around the same time. So it was probably inspired by, but Dung Beetles is essentially the idea behind it was like, you're a bug and you're eating food, presumably off of dung, but it's kind of like a Pac-Man maze. Like, there's little dots that you have to eat, but the thing is, you can't see everything. You're looking at a microscope view of part of the maze at any given time. So
I see.
The microscope zoom kind of obscures enemies that are coming after you immediately around you. So you kind of have to like very quickly react. And again, it was a pretty advanced game for Apple too at the time.
Pretty original concept for the time, you'd think, right?
Yeah. And I don't think it ever, I haven't found it on the Atari platform. Maybe it's on the Commodore, but I don't think it ever leapt platforms. I think it was just a uniquely, I think it was like MicroProse,
right?
Which is a, you know, a company that made software for lots of different platforms.
So while you were playing all these games in school, you should have been learning BASIC, John. You should have been programming in BASIC instead of playing all these games.
That's what we told the teacher we were doing. Because the thing is, when I was doing the Apple II stuff, our school district, we had one Apple II. Mm-hmm. And it was a fairly small school. It was a very small town up north, not too far from where you were raised. Mm-hmm. And but the computer was in the room directly beside my classroom, my elementary school classroom. And I don't know how we did it, but we convinced the teacher that, well, you should give us some quality time to learn these computer things because I think they're going to be the future. And so I swear, like we got like probably a half a day a week or maybe more frequent than that, that we could literally me and a couple other students, we got to go and sort of explore all the options with the computer. And
very good.
And then the idea was that we'd report back to the class and show them what we've learned, and then they could try it as well. So it was quite a magical time for probably an 8 or 9 year old at the time.
No kidding. Well, and good for you for taking advantage of those opportunities back then. And even back then, you were, you know, sort of, you know, very much aware of what your interests were, right? So that's a really really neat story. Our computer lab, I remember. We had just a room full of Apple II computers, and we didn't have in elementary school. We had no computers, but in high school, there was a computer lab full of, like, I think there were, would they have been clone machines at the time? Did clones exist of the Apple II?
Probably,
1980, 83, 80, 84.
Apple did a pretty good job of getting into the educational market back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Clearly they did. Well, speaking of the educational market, we're going to skip about a decade and a half here, or more, actually. in about 2012 or so. So the iPad, of course, came out in around 2010, right? I think it was. So around 2012, something like that, right? Yeah. So I decided I wanted to learn how to program. Like I wanted to take a course. I wanted to formally force myself to learn like iOS, as it was known at the time, programming. Right. I wanted to learn how to develop iPad apps. I was specifically interested in the iPad because I wanted to make apps for my son. That's actually was my whole motivation. Mm-hmm. So I actually took a course at the local technical institute. And, you know, I know I could have learned this stuff on my own, but it really forced me into that environment where you're accountable, you have assignments and all that kind of business. Yeah. Right. So it's all those good reasons. And so I worked with my son to design. He was 2 or 3 years old at the time to design this app that would be a sports scoreboard, which is basically like you'd see in a hockey rink or a you know, football stadium, basketball, whatever. You've got the score, the time, all that stuff you'd expect to see with lots of little features and things of that nature. So I designed this app on paper, and then as part of my school assignment, actually completed the app and put it in the Apple App Store. And I subsequently built a few other apps after that, and they're actually still in the App Store. And I consider it to be some of the best work I've ever done in my life. Because, and I'm not saying it's spectacular, these apps are spectacular, but I am particularly proud of how that went and working with my son, all that kind of stuff. So fast forward to when I started getting back into retro computing. And I think I mentioned in our Commodore 64 episode that I got interested in this stuff again because the C64 mini sparked my interest. So I started played some games on that, and you know got my load runner fix in, right? And then was trying to think, well, what else did I used to do with these computers? Well, yeah, I used to program. I used to write programs all the time. So why not revisit basic programming, you know 30 years later? I gave myself the project of converting or recreating my scoreboard app, but in BASIC on the Commodore 64. That was this is my task. So I set out, I spent the better part of a week, you know, a few hours a day, like basically, right? You like that? relearning Commodore Basic, and then quickly realizing the limitations of Commodore Basic compared to modern programming languages.
Yeah.
But what I did discover is there are modern development tools that will help us that we certainly wish we would have had back in the day, but that will greatly expedite the time it takes to develop for on these old platforms. So the one application for writing Commodore apps or Commodore programs with is it's called CBM PRG Studio, I believe. CBM PRG Studio. It's like picture like Visual Studio or whatever it's called, like the Microsoft tool, but specifically for Commodore computers. Also, whether you're writing BASIC or assembly language, it has all the debuggers and all this. It's really a fantastic environment. So I learned how to use that to rebuild my scoreboard app in Commodore BASIC. And I'm committed to doing a YouTube video for our listening audience, viewing audience, and I'll show you the iPad iOS version of the scoreboard compared to the Commodore version of the scoreboard. But it forced me to revisit those limitations of Commodore BASIC. You don't have things like, there's no such thing as an else statement. There's an if then, but there's no else. There's no such thing as like true functions or subroutines. You have to sort of use the limitations of go subs and returns and all this kind of thing in order to sort of mimic that. But what it did force me to do was to really think out the flow of the program before actually committing to code. And that's something that the 12-year-old Dave probably wouldn't have been able to do or had that foresight. Certainly didn't have the modern development tools, but I ran into a limitation with Commodore BASIC where I won't go on and on about this because I want to show it in the YouTube video, but it uses sprites to display the digits, say the clock, like, so there's a clock that's counting down, like the time clock. So I actually am using like large sprite graphics to represent the numbers. And one of the challenges I had was that, say, after 4 or 5 minutes of running, because I wanted to test this thing to make sure it would work properly. After running it for 4 or 5 minutes, the graphics would actually corrupt themselves. Like the digits would become garbled. And it didn't make any sense to me whatsoever why it would happen. But so imagine, you know, going to the internet to try to find the answer to, like, you're not going to Stack Overflow or, you know, right? For this problem, right?
Yeah.
I'm going into PDF Overflow. I'm going to, look at old Commodore 64 programming books to try to find the answer. And lo and behold, I actually solved my problem. And it was thanks to I don't remember which book, but it was a specific book about sprite graphics on the Commodore 64. And I remember finding this answer in this 35-year-old book to this challenge that was driving me mental. But anyway, I got it fixed. And what was happening, I think, was the address space or the memory space where I was storing the sprite data was somehow, you know, became, I needed to reallocate it somewhere else so it didn't conflict with some other things. And long story short is I figured out how to do that. And now I could run my scoreboard for an infinite amount of time. So that's my story. But I guess, you know, going back to the, you know, the unfinished kill 2048 or whatever it was. So in this case, I ran into a roadblock, but I pushed through it. I went beyond what the 12-year-old Dave would have done. And I persevered and I got through my challenge. Right. So maybe, you know, maybe there's a little life lesson there for all of us.
Yeah.
Another thing that in modern times, I think I mentioned to you, John, a few months ago that I have, and I'm holding this in my hand right now, is my beloved Mattel Electronics Football 2 game. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I wanted to give myself another basic programming challenge. I looked at it and I thought, I still play this game to this day once in a while. It's one of, you know, the two or three games I think I was ever good at in any way. I love this game. And I decided, I wonder if Commodore 64 BASIC would be fast enough to run this game. Like, could I rewrite this game, this Football 2 game, on the Commodore 64 using BASIC? Is it possible? So, I sat down for a couple hours. I fired up, you know, the studio program. I drew out the field of play. And then I decided I needed to know, am I going to be able to simulate the player movement and some of that logic in a way that this would actually be playable to any degree on the Commodore 64? And I did that and I got it to about a place where the game might be like 30% done. And I realized I don't think it's going to be fast enough. I think it's just going to feel a little bit laggy. So instead of giving up on it, I looked into, I've been always been curious about compilers that will compile BASIC into machine code, like into assembly language. Like they always have been out there, even back in the old days, they were there, but, and I wasn't smart enough to figure out how they worked or what, you know, what this would actually do. But there's one similar tool that I discovered, and it's actually pretty new. I think it's only a few years old. It's called XC Basic. And what it is it's a dialect of BASIC that will compile itself directly to machine code. So it's a dialect of BASIC specifically meant for this purpose, to compile to machine code. So you're not taking regular Commodore BASIC and trying to convert it to assembly language. You're actually explicitly using this new variant. And it has a whole bunch of other commands as well that will like give you different capabilities. So some things that you wish you had as BASIC commands that aren't there in regular BASIC, like plotting things specifically on the screen in certain places. So there's these new BASIC commands for doing some of those things that will, again, compile directly to machine code. So I started line by line. I just spent like an hour one Sunday just sort of converting my work in progress football game to this new XC BASIC. And I just had so much fun, and I was killing it. Any real seasoned programmers would of course laugh at my, you know, my work, but it was so much fun, and I was really, and you could see the performance increase, and it was really motivational. I need to re-pick up that project. I'd really like to see that through to completion. So
how far do you think you got?
Yeah, again, probably like maybe 20 to 30% of the way through. You know, fortunately, like the reason why I like choosing a game like this is because the graphics are simple. It doesn't require any high res stuff. The controls are simple. It just seems like the kind of a game that would translate very well to an old 8-bit computer. So I got to see that. I got to see that project through. I have to, you know, channel that, but it's just so much fun. As you know, you're a man of many interests and projects, and once you get hooked on something, on a project, you just don't want to put it down, right?
Yeah,
you're so engaged.
I get the blinders and I don't think or breathe anything else the whole time. I'm curious how you dealt with the game's logic though, because it's one thing to get the graphics to look right and have them move in a certain predefined way, but then to add on that other layer. I mean, that makes my brain hurt just thinking about the logic you need to build in for a football game.
Yes.
Basically you need to teach it how to play football.
That's right.
Now, understand the rules of football.
Yeah, absolutely. And fortunately, as you know, the rule set in these handheld games is, you know, it's a pretty dumbed down variant of the game. Yeah. It's not Madden, right?
Yeah.
It's nothing of that nature where you different set plays and things like that. The mechanics are very simple. You've got a quarterback and you've got a receiver and you've got the ball, and then you've got a bunch of defenders. And the defenders, it's pretty easy to, you know, having the, you know, hundreds of hours of playtime that I've played this game in my life, and I literally can play this game in my sleep. You learn the patterns. You know which direction the players are going to go. So also, believe it or not, the documentation for the game does a reasonably good job of explaining how the defense works in the game.
Right.
Because that's really what you need to program is the defense and how to, you know, how to have the defenders try to, say, intercept the ball or tackle the player. Another challenge was trying to figure out, because the game has a couple of different speeds, like sort of a pro mode or a regular mode. I wanted to try to replicate that as well. So I wanted to be able to slow down or speed up the gameplay depending on the mode of the game. So I had to build that into the logic and in the main sort of loop of the game. I also read Compute magazine used to publish a bunch of books in addition to their magazines back in the day that would be specific topics, like specific to game programming or specific to assembly language. So they published a book on specifically on game programming that actually taught me a lot about like how to like architect, you know, the logic of the game. So, but now I could just have ChatGPT write the whole thing for me anyways, but yeah, that you hit on the biggest challenge is figuring out. And the thing is, do I still know that I'd be able to make it look and feel exactly like the real game? No, I don't. That's still going to require some testing, but I actually feel like it's well on its way. I got through the first couple of hurdles. I thought, yeah, I'm going to be able to do this. I'm actually going to be able to, I mean, you know, at least it'll look similar and feel similar. It will be exactly the same, but still pretty fun exercise though. Like,
I mean, there's a lot going on in that. It's interesting, not necessarily those handhelds, but you remember the sort of little Coleco arcade machine handhelds?
I do.
They had like Ms. Pac-Man, Pac-Man. Yep. I think there was a Donkey Kong, Galaga, maybe a Centipede.
Yes.
There's actually an emulator that will reproduce those.
Yes.
And I think in a lot of ways, it's very similar to your Mattel football as far as the simple LED graphics and stuff like that, and just a simple pattern movements and lighting up these things. But I just remember seeing the emulator and was so impressed by it because it was able to, you know, you just basically choose the game and it would switch to the right color scheme and bezels and all that kind of stuff like you would expect with like a regular RetroPie or whatever. But it was that slightly they're very like physical because you can actually see the LEDs even if they're off.
That's right.
And so I found that the emulator even emulated that kind of look. Like it looked like an unlit LED field even when you were playing.
Yeah. Amazing. See, that's level up stuff. And I had Donkey Kong back then.
Yeah.
Run 82. Did you have one?
I had Pac-Man. Yeah. I might've had Galaga as well. I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I had a couple of them and my sister had Miss Pac-Man.
Nice. They were all, and I think they're highly collectible today.
They usually go like on Marketplace or Craigslist for like at least $100, if not more, depending on the quality or the condition.
Well, I remember I wore the jump button out on my Donkey Kong. and I think my parents actually took it back to the store if I remember correctly.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And I probably asked them to do that maybe, but I played the heck out of that thing. And secretly I wanted, you know, I think there were only two of the levels. Of course, it's so limited.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
But I still remember loving it, but I also remember secretly hoping that a third level would get unlocked sometime, but it didn't happen. Didn't happen.
But you could maybe program the emulator to give you that third level.
That's right. And the emulator is great too, by the way. You told me about that a few months ago and I checked it out. So, we'll see. I'll report back on my Mattel football game conversion. Maybe I'll carve out a few hours here in the summer and plug away at XC Basic. So I recommend anyone who wants to get into basic programming or wants to improve the performance of their basic programs to look at XC Basic or even just getting back into the traditional Commodore BASIC dialect and understanding its limitations. If you've been a programmer in modern times, to go back there will really make you appreciate some of the things that we have now with our development tools. So
very cool. So to wrap up this episode, we thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about some of the people that are listening to this podcast. Dave and I just do this podcast for fun for us, but you know, it's really exciting to get some letters and notes from people around the world that have actually been listening. So Dave, why don't you talk about the note we got from Carlos?
Sure. Yes. No, thanks, John. And you're right. It's really great to receive feedback from our listeners. It's really exciting to know that we're building a bit of an audience. So Carlos wrote to us from Chile. Carlos said he thanked us for the podcast and he was looking around for something related to BBSs on Spotify and then found our podcast that way. So thank you, Spotify and your SEO for that. He says it was amazing and now he's already hooked up, enjoying all the episodes, thanking us for our efforts. And Carlos reminisced about his first experience with the BBS was with his father. His father showed him BBSs when he was younger and sort of got him familiar with it. And he was looking to reconnect with some of those memories. So that was really, really cool to hear your story, Carlos. And we hope you enjoy the rest of our podcast as we continue on. It's motivational to know that you enjoyed it.
It's really cool. He mentions that he's using a piece of software called SyncTerm to access BBSs via SSH, presumably on a modern computer. He doesn't get into exactly what he's running that on, but that sounds pretty cool. Like just basically using a terminal service to connect to some of these BBSs that are connected to the internet now, which is Very cool.
Yeah, it's awesome. Indeed. So thanks, Carlos. And another listener that we heard from is Connor. Our Con goes by Con. Connor Doak, I guess, last name there. Connor told us that he wanted to let us know how much he enjoys listening to the 8-Bit Files. He was born in 82, which it was a vintage year for computing. And he grew up in the UK with a Sinclair Spectrum, a ZX Spectrum Plus, one of those machines that we just didn't have over here, right, John? Amongst many of those other 8-bit micros that we didn't have.
Yeah, there was a lot of different ones that I'd only ever heard about in magazines. There's the Sinclair, of course, the Acorn, the Oric, the Amstrad, the Dragon. There's a bunch of ones that I only ever saw mentioned in magazines. And we were talking before we started recording about, I used to go to this magazine store and they had like a British magazine section. And they had all these amazing magazines that were so much more interesting than the North American ones. And they were all computer and video game based, and they were tabloid size. So they were very large compared to the North American style, which is, you know, your very simple magazine style. But these large format, I guess they're A4 size. So they would be awkward on the shelf for one. And these ones all came with a disc, you know, depending on the era, floppy, 3.5 inch or a CD eventually. And they were all showing off these really cool computers, like the ZX Spectrum or ZX Spectrum. It looked really cool. Like some of these computers looked really neat, but we never got them over here. Yeah. And I've never actually seen some of these in person. Yeah. And they're all kind of in the same, you know, price ranges are Ataris and Commodores and stuff like that. But Connor mentions that he eventually got a Commodore Amiga, which was sort of the computer of the 90s, which we'll talk about in a future episode, most likely. But I kind of missed that era. I didn't miss the Commodore era, the Commodore Amiga era. I was into the Atari ST at the time, right. Save that for a future episode. But
well, it's kind of interesting that, of course, the 64 seemingly was more popular over here in North America. Mm-hmm. Yet the Amiga was not popular here at all. It was much more popular over in places like Europe and whatnot. So it's kind of funny how that went. But
well, it's interesting too, because the Amiga became a very niche product for filmmakers and video people, because it was one of the few computers that had a really good quality output. And there was a lot of really interesting software, like the Video Toaster, that allowed editors to do some really creative stuff back in the day before you could do this with computers. You had to use dedicated, you know, desks that had all this editing capability built into it.
Yeah, that's really the only use case for the Amiga. Well, not the only use case, but the primary use case in North America was in those environments, right? Like my friend took video editing, studied video production in school in the early 90s, and he had a video, he had an Amiga for the Video Toaster. I wish I would have actually got to play with that a little bit more, but here we go. But thanks, Con, for getting in touch with us. And you've motivated us to check out, through emulation, some of these older machines. There are whole libraries of games and software, of course, for all those computers that we never got exposed to when we were kids. So,
yeah,
I appreciate you checking in. So we really appreciate hearing from you. And we encourage and would love feedback, really, to us. We enjoy doing this, like John said, just, you know, for fun, because it's so enjoyable just to talk, but it's even extra special if we do hear from our audience. So please drop us an email if you have any feedback or questions about anything that you've heard. We are at the8bitfiles@gmail.com for email, or you can visit our website at the8bitfiles.com and just submit our contact form there. And we would love to hear from you.
With that, I think we're going to sign off for this episode, the basic programming episode of the 8-Bit Files. As Dave mentioned, you can get in touch with us a number of different ways, including on Twitter, now X, I guess, Instagram. We've got a YouTube channel with some stuff coming from Dave, and I'm going to try to do some stuff as well. And then, of course, our website, the8bitfiles.com. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Dave.
See you next time.
Take care, everybody.